This is our second podcast.
Our first podcast was about Alien.
You should go check it out if you haven't already.
Yeah, we decided to take a dramatic departure.
Yes.
And marathon all of the Harry Potter movies.
We are currently on the third one.
We just finished the third one.
Yeah.
And we've decided to talk about the movies in installments. So not do a podcast for every one, but...
Because we have lives.
Yeah, well, we don't have enough lives that
we don't have enough life to
you
us.
You know, haven't watched the last three movies in the last 3 days.
That's
but
right.
But yeah, we figured we would watch the first three and then do a recording because the first two are they meld in together in an interesting way, and the third one is a very dramatic change. So we figured it would be good to talk about that, the direction.
So I think maybe we should sort of set the scene about how long it's been since for each of us since watching these movies. For me, I think I haven't watched one, two, or three since they came out in theaters, because I think around that time I kind of stopped keeping up with them. So it's been maybe, I think, for the first one, it's been at least 13 or 14 years.
Wow.
Second one, same thing, like 12 years. Yeah, it's been more than a decade since I've seen the third one.
Wow. Okay, that's crazy, because so I have seen all of the movies multiple times. I can't remember how long it's been since I've seen the first two. If I were to guess, I would say it's probably been, you know, 6 years or so, maybe 7 years since I've seen the first two. But I've seen the third one more recently. Mm. Yeah, it's definitely, I've definitely seen all of the movies multiple times. So there were many things I was excited for in each movie. Like when I could see that things were coming up, I thought, oh my God, it's time for the Dementors.
Right.
So what was it like for you to not see them basically since they've come out?
When I first saw them, I was very much a fan of the books. And so I was trying to, I was obviously a lot younger. Like I was, I think, 12 when I saw the first one. And I was trying to correlate the contents of the movie with the books. And sort of, I almost felt like I was supposed to be a gatekeeper of sorts, figure out where they were deviating from the source. I think I enjoyed it a lot more just as a passive spectator this time, because I wasn't, I couldn't remember anything from the books. I had all this sort of store of knowledge, so that I was kind of like, oh wait, why does that happen? Oh wait, I think it's because, as we were talking about with some of the backstories of characters, we could kind of piece it together based on our mutual knowledge of what had happened. So I enjoyed the movies more as stories, watching them, than before, where I was just trying to make sure that they didn't change the book.
Yeah, I kind of feel the same way. When I was watching the movies originally, well, I saw the first two movies when they came out before I started the books. So the movies seemed very new and fresh to me at first.
Right.
Then I started reading the books. I read the first three, which were the ones that were out. And then when the third movie came out, it was a surprise to me. Like, the third movie was amazing for many reasons, but mostly because I didn't know what was going to happen. Since watching them and since a lot of time has passed, enjoyed seeing them for what they are. I no longer really think about, you know, this is different from the books, because I don't remember. It's been over a decade since I've read the book, so I don't even remember when the last one came out.
I actually preferred watching the third one to reading the book. Not that I quite remember what the book was, but I just felt the compression in this movie, in this third movie. When I first saw it originally, I was just kind of annoyed at all the stuff that didn't make it from the book. And then watching this movie, like, we just watched some of the deleted scenes, and I was like, these scenes were so pointless. And so, like, they were in the book, but they added absolutely nothing to the movie, and it was just, it just would have dragged it on. So I'm really glad that they weren't included. I'm really glad that it was so concise and so tight. Like, it's the shortest Harry Potter movie, and it just, it feels like a real movie. It doesn't feel like an adaptation of a book.
Yeah, it feels like a movie in itself for sure. And I mean, the third movie is just, it's just so great. I mean, we literally just spent the entire time watching it talking about how great it was compared to the first two. And it's just, it's so different in tone, like, for so many reasons. It really is the first point in the series where you realize that there's a lot more going on in the wizarding world outside of what's happening just at Hogwarts. I mean, I noticed in the movie they did not mention the names of the houses even once the whole time. They never talk about the House Cup. They never talk about, they literally never mention anybody else. There are no other real students that make an appearance. Like, they don't talk about the Ravenclaws or the Hufflepuffs, or they don't mention anything. Like, all issues with Slytherin being the evil house, it's just never mentioned at all. They really only encounter, you know, Malfoy and his goons, and that's kind of it. Yeah. It's almost like the house rivalries don't even exist in this movie.
They did away with a lot of the silliness. I felt in the second one, the tension was constantly being deflated because it was so preposterous, like insinuation that Malfoy could somehow be the heir of Slytherin, and then they have to do the Polyjuice potion, very pathetically trying to extract a confession from him.
Yeah.
And it's just so, it's so juvenile. And I think as a child, you kind of don't really care because it's in the book. But watching it as an adult, and
as an adult, you're just like,
who acts like this?
Yeah, yeah. No, it's really just funny as an adult. And I mean, I never really think, I didn't think of it as silly. It is very much so a kid's movie. Like the first two are, you know, we're not really the target audience. So
yeah,
it worked for when it came out and when we were that age. But the second movie in particular spent so long pitting Gryffindor against Slytherin, just because of the whole plot of who is the heir of Slytherin. And there are multiple times in the movie where, for a really kind of contrived reason, Harry versus Draco is like what happens throughout the entire movie. And it doesn't even really make sense. Like, there's just so many situations where it's just like, oh, surprise, Draco's on the Quidditch team now. Oh, surprise, yeah, you're going to drool. You're going to duel against him too.
Like, they might have been drooling.
Yeah, maybe
each other.
Drooling,
we don't
know. But it's just, there's so many contrived situations, especially like all of the stuff with Lucius,
yeah,
and coming in and just being all like, man.
And he was such a, he was such a caricature.
He's so awesome.
But again, the acting,
he's like Snape. He's overacting the shit out of it.
And for me, it was just, it was so bizarre to watch. Like the actor, I can't remember, Jason Isaacs,
Jason,
I think.
Yeah.
I'm a really big fan of his stuff. Like, I think he plays a really good villain. But just watching it, the, you know, the hair flips and the squinty eyes, and it was just, it was baffling that anyone in this world was a real human being.
Yeah, it's very ridiculous, especially considering his behavior towards 12-year-olds.
Yeah,
it's
like,
just
he almost kills him
at
he's
the end.
He's so angry,
legit,
and he's
almost
about to, and he's saved by, he's stopped by a house elf, and it's, I was just like, this is not a realistic environment.
Yeah, yeah, just the way he acts towards Harry and Ginny, even,
like, what,
and it's
what
just
did
like,
what did he think was going to happen? That he would kill Harry Potter and just walk away?
Just walk away. But Harry Potter lost me my servant! Like, no one cares.
I couldn't beat my house elf anymore.
Oh, God.
The boy had it coming. He slipped into the curse, you all saw.
Yeah, it is pretty ridiculous, like, the introduction of all of that. And you really, really, at least for me, got to see how, you know, how Draco became the disgusting human that he is.
He's such a sniveling little rat.
He's so awful. So awful. And you just, he's the kind of character you kind of love to hate.
Let's
yeah.
talk about the first one.
Let's talk about the first movie. Oh my God, yeah. First movie. Okay. You spend a lot of time talking about the whimsy.
So whimsical.
All about the whimsy.
I felt like they were aware that they, obviously they knew there was going to be 7 books because she had mentioned there were 7 years in the school.
She had mentioned, but it wasn't like they were written. And
you got the sense that they knew they were setting things up. Mm-hmm. And so everything is just so opulent and beautiful and full of promise. You know, they go to a wand shop and there's nooks and crannies and everything just feels kind of like there's stuff going on.
Well, there's a sense of wonder constantly. Like,
yes.
Harry is seeing all of these things for the first time. And as the audience, Harry has always been, like, the everyman in these movies, I feel like. Like, you always experience things through his eyes. There are all these situations where, you know, he trips and falls into a doorway. And that's how you learn about a new thing as he's learning about it. So the first movie really focuses our attention onto that. Like, that scene where he sees Diagon Alley for the first time. It's like you see his face light up and then the camera spins around and you see all of that. So it's like you really are meant to experience the wonder as he does. And I feel like the second movie just kind of does away with that. He's discovering new things still. Every movie, in fact, is showing us new things. But in the second movie especially, it's almost like you were saying this as well, like these things just happen in the background, like it's almost taken for granted.
I kept complaining about that. And I think it was just more obvious having just seen the first one, the way that the second one, it's a much longer movie, but it feels like there's less content in there simply because the entrance to Hogwarts, for example, is just a flyby in a car.
Yeah.
Even in the third one, they just have one shot where it's them showing up in these carriages and it just sets the tone and it sets
yeah.
the world so perfectly that I felt that a flyby in a car, it ruins the mystique of this
yeah.
of this school, and it just turns it into, oh, well, we're back at Hogwarts.
Yeah.
We got to go through this again.
It's interesting because in the first movie and then the third movie, and I don't remember all the rest, but it's like you feel like Harry, like you've kind of been imprisoned throughout the whole summer and you can't wait till we get back to school because this is where you really can be who you are. Mm-hmm. And that's why there's always this grand entrance to Hogwarts, like, oh my God, I'm here. But yeah, you're right. In the second movie, it's just like they crash their car. They go in. It's like not a big deal that they're even there. Everything in that movie seems to happen in the background. They experience these things. And now we literally watched it yesterday and I can't even really remember any of the new elements of the second movie.
I remember Kenneth Branagh.
I remember him quite well. Yes. What do they even do in that movie? I know we literally watched it yesterday.
Something about a chamber.
There's a chamber.
There's a few secrets exchanged.
Yeah. There's a giant snake.
Yes.
Yeah. So
there's
we learn about
kissing involved.
Yeah, we learn about Parseltongue.
Yes.
I guess we see a duel for the first time. Yeah.
Voldemort is finally introduced as a... Oh, no, he's introduced as
he's
a villain
introduced
in the first one.
The first one for sure. He's on the back of...
Yes.
Some guy's head.
Who's wearing a very inappropriate turban.
Yeah. Yeah, no, the second one... Oh, yeah, Polyjuice Potion is introduced, which I know comes into play later on. I'm pretty sure they use it again in, like, the seventh movie or something.
I can't even remember. That whole sequence was, like, 30 minutes that didn't need to be in that movie.
It's just very, very long, especially considering how awkward they are while trying to play Crabbe and Goyle and how it really just... It's so obvious that it's them. Like, their voices are the same, and it's just such a silly scene. It doesn't seem like a believable scene. Why would Draco just be hanging out in this room just being all, like, shit-talking everyone? Like, is that just what he actually does in his spare time?
But, I mean, from a narrative perspective, it was... I just remember in the book there actually being the suggestion that maybe it was Draco, and I was willing to believe
Right. And in the movie, it seems ridiculous.
I don't want to say that Tom Felton did a bad job, but I never once thought that this was a legitimate potential candidate for the heir. And so...
Yeah.
It's a 30-minute detour in this movie that I think everyone knows is not the case.
It's true, yeah. You never really get the sense that he's the heir because even though, you know, at one point Ron makes the one connection and says, oh, who do we know that wants to get rid of all the mudbloods? Like, okay, that's fine, but he's not, like, you never really see Draco as, like a mastermind or as even a remotely serious enough person to pull off a huge plot like this, so it doesn't really seem like...
I hadn't even thought of it to that dimension. I just thought as a character, he's such a jerk.
That... Yeah, but also, like, you just don't really think that he will play such a huge role. I mean, the only time he's given any real responsibility will be later in the sixth movie.
Yeah, and I don't want to talk too much about it
but
I do think that even there, in the sixth movie, just a brief detour, he's not calling the shots either.
Yeah.
He's just being told what to do.
Yeah, he's actually just a very, very weak character who follows orders and doesn't really have much will of his own and doesn't even really know the reason why he acts the way he does. It's just,
His parents were jerks.
His parents were jerks.
I guess.
And Lucius Malfoy has his dramatic hair flips and you just gotta follow him, gotta follow what he does. I love that he has his wand like in a sheath, kind of like a sword.
It's clandestine.
It's very... And it has, like, a fancy hilt on it, too.
It's a snake head, isn't it?
Maybe, yeah. It looks like he's, like, about to do some fencing or something. What do you think about the idea of every movie kind of introducing new characters, but then you never see them again? Like, it happens with a lot of the professors. In the first movie, you never see... What's her face? Madame Hooch.
Pro. Oh.
You don't see Madame Hooch again,
yeah.
Yeah, and then you don't see Sprout again.
Until the second one, and she's only in it for that brief moment.
Yeah, she serves her purpose.
Yeah.
And you never see her again. Yeah, they're just kind of like, they introduce these people, they drop them in, and then they take them out. It's weird, because having read the books, I remember at the time feeling a bit disappointed that there weren't more cameos of more characters. Like, the fact that you never meet the two older Weasley brothers is also very strange to me, because they mention their names all the time, but you literally never meet them.
I think from a filmmaking perspective, it's a lot more difficult to bring in an actor, especially some of the professors are big, not maybe big name, but some of them are more high profile, like, you know, Emma Thompson, bringing Emma Thompson in just for a cameo. There's a lot of logistics involved in getting them in there. And so in a book, you can just sort of say, you know, Professor Trelawney was at the table as
well. Oh, yeah, completely.
And to actually get Emma Thompson to show up just to have her face in the frame for no reason is like, would be nice, but it.
Oh yeah, I totally get why they don't have all of these people come in, but it was to me a very noticeable thing while watching the movie.
But that also for me was some of the biggest problems with watching 1 and 2 is that it was so slavish to the source material, like right down to the whole. Then there's the whole subplot with the spiders, right? And it happens.
Oh god, the spiders thing takes so long.
There's so many. Like that movie could have been an hour and a half.
Yeah, it's. What were you saying that it was the longest movie?
I think it's two hours and 42 minutes.
Yeah, like, there are so many scenes that
so many
are
dead
so
turns,
long.
And there's a whole thing where he goes inside Tom's memories and finds out that it's Hagrid. Of course, it's not Hagrid.
And then, it's like, do you ever actually think that Hagrid did anything wrong? No.
When I read the book, I actually was like, oh my god, now this character has been brought into a new focus for me. Maybe it is Hagrid. And, you know, but at the same time, you're like, no, you know, it can't be true. But yeah, you're watching and you don't ever actually believe that it's Hagrid. So that's another 20 minutes that's spent wasting our time taking us another direction. Then Hagrid gives him this stupid advice to go into the forest.
The spider's thing takes so long.
Talk to a stupid spider. Like, how is a spider petrifying people? How does a spider petrify a ghost? Doesn't even make any sense.
All they learn, and it's funny because Ron even says after they leave the spider's den, like, well, that was totally pointless.
Yes.
As if that excuses it. Yeah, like, they literally went in there, and all they learned was that it wasn't Hagrid.
Yeah.
A, everybody knew that. Nobody thought it was Hagrid. B, if they had to prove it in a court of law,
a giant spider
was going to come testify so that Hagrid doesn't go to Azkaban. Like,
it makes no sense.
You got to believe me, a giant spider said that Hagrid did nothing wrong. Like, that is...
And the car rescued us. He'll testify.
The car rescued us.
White twice for yes.
Yeah, it's literally a 20-minute sequence that just doesn't even need to be in the movie. I felt like it was the movie... I think there are many situations in the movie where they said to themselves, oh my god, people liked the first movie. We got enough money to make the second one.
Yeah.
Let's show off all the special effects.
Look at all this shit we don't need.
Look at this giant set. Yeah.
The special effects were a lot better.
Yeah, they're a lot better.
The sets were incredible.
Yeah, and I feel like they really wanted to show all that stuff off a lot. I think it was almost like a deliverable. Like, look at what we've done with all the money you gave us.
Yeah.
Let's make the movie longer.
Yeah.
Put in really long sequences of spiders trickling down webs just so you can see we've done it.
And I think I was saying this to you earlier, that if the third movie had been more of that, if it had been another, like if it had been, because they could have easily made that a 3-hour snooze fest. And if it had been more of that kind of, oh, there's secrets in the cast, why don't we have to figure them out? I don't think we would have made it to episode 7. Like, I don't, they might have kept making it to episode 7,
but I don't think people
would have been watching.
People wouldn't have been interested if they'd kept it up because, like, yeah, the first two movies are literally Harry Potter and the Nancy Drew mystery. Like, it's ridiculous. You and I were laughing about it when we were watching them. It's just.
Well, the stakes were so...
The stakes are really low, but
they're Nancy Drew stakes.
Yeah, like, they're made to seem really high.
Yeah.
But it's like, oh, here's a totally ridiculous plot happening just contained within the walls of this school. It has to do with Voldemort, which makes it seem like a big deal, but it's like, it's ridiculous. Even in the first movie, like, nobody is aware of anything, and all of a sudden, it's like from that first moment where they see the three-headed dog, they're running away, and Hermione's like, did you notice the three-headed dog was standing on top of a trap door? It's guarding something. It must be that thing that was stolen from Gringotts Bank. Like, where are you getting this from?
The level of inferences that they make in these movies.
The leaps are just like...
Well, it was the best was in the second one, when they're just throwing out these statistics.
And oh my God.
You and I were looking at each other like, with Dumbledore gone, half the school will be petrified.
The mudbloods don't stand a chance.
We'll be losing a mudblood a week or something.
A day.
At a geometric rate. Like, how do you know this? It's been an entire semester and one person's been petrified and you're like...
A cat.
One a day will now happen.
And I love how they automatically just jump towards the Chamber of Secrets. Oh my god, we've got to find out what it is. Like, all they see is the blood.
I think it's the chamber.
The Chamber of Secrets has been opened. And then, okay, they ask McGonagall what it is, and they learn what it is. But then how do they even make the connection that somebody has opened it in the school
right.
that they then have to investigate. Like, it just, it's so ridiculous that they don't, they're just deducing shit all over the place.
Even in the first instance with the cat being petrified and the blood on the thing, no one even questions whether it's just a prank.
Yeah, yeah.
They're just like, totally, no, this is legit because it's written in blood on a wall.
It looks ridiculous.
Let's
like
not
you watch
test
it.
The blood. Yeah. Let's not do any CSI shit. Let's just assume...
Wizarding CSI.
It's a wizard school. Of course the Chamber of Secrets has been reopened.
Yeah.
It's been a legend for 1,000 years. Of course it's real.
Yeah, there are so many situations where... Even in the third movie, this happened. Business will be going as usual, and then an announcement will be made, usually by Dumbledore, being like, P.S., some terrible thing is gonna kill everyone in the school. It's in the school. Let's just chill out until something bad happens, and then we're gonna patrol the corridors.
Yeah.
Everyone's gotta be in bed by 6 p.m.
Yeah.
We're gonna get to the bottom of this. And then, you know, in the second movie, McGonagall's like, the school might have to close. Like, oh my God. Like, yeah, that'll be the worst thing in the world, the school closing. And also, they're aware of all of these really terrible death traps within the school that they've not bothered to do anything about before this moment.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not been a problem at all.
But now suddenly, because three people have been petrified and there is a known cure, the school will have to close.
Yeah, the school will have to close. But even in the first movie, it's the same sort of thing. Like, oh my God, like, the Philosopher's Stone, it's been stolen. It's been cut loose in the school. Like, why does Dumbledore ask Hagrid to bring it into the school? Why? Doesn't Dumbledore have places to stash his powerful
like a beard or something?
Yeah.
You can
like,
shove
doesn't
it in?
He just have places to do this? And
yeah.
It's pretty amazing to me, though, that just how, you know, convoluted a lot of these little hints are for the audience, because, you know, you see Harry, you know, go to the Gringotts Bank for the first time. He's literally found out that he was a wizard, like, the night before. Everything is really, really new to him. And he seems to remember that the number, vault that they
oh,
went
yeah,
into.
Because that's what you do
thing,
when you're introduced to a new universe.
A new
you
universe
remember
entirely.
Numbers.
You remember a number, and you remember the fact that somebody just picked up a small package there. And then you somehow deduce that it's being guarded by a three-headed dog.
Yeah.
Later. It's,
and of course it's all true.
It's all true. That's the worst part.
Because it's a kid's movie and it's already too long and we just need to move on.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like that's how the logic of this movie works. And so I really appreciate in the later ones how it becomes less of this kind of juvenile deduction. And it's more just like, no, it happened because Voldemort did it or somebody did it. Like it's all like consequential activity. It's not, oh, you know, all of these sort of traps and puzzles were set eons ago. And now
you three are here and you must solve it. Hermione's the smartest.
Yeah.
She's going to figure stuff out.
Yeah.
Harry is constantly in danger and everyone and everything is trying to kill him, including objects.
Yeah.
You can't. I always used to laugh because literally Harry, this entire movie and universe unfolds because Harry can't do simple things correctly. Like, he can't do anything. He can't be in a car. He can't walk down a street. He can't do anything because he's always falling over into things. Like, the entire introduction of Nocturne Alley is because he
can't
uses
say the word
flu network incorrectly.
He cannot say the word Diagon.
Diagon. That part's hilarious.
Diagonally.
Diagonally. Yeah. But this is how, you know, the movie takes the audience through things, which I, as an adult, find irritating because I think this is very, very contrived. I think, obviously, we're only being shown these things because Harry is being thrown around. And everyone always talks about him being this very talented wizard, very brave, very whatever. He's actually not an extraordinary character in any way.
Until the third one.
Why until the third one?
Because in the third one, he finally starts doing magic. He summons the Patronus.
Right.
And I love the way that they handle that in the movie because the soundtrack drops out and it actually just gives Daniel Radcliffe as Harry Potter a moment to actually, A, show that he's capable of emoting, and B, like, I think that's the turning point when Harry Potter actually starts taking some agency in his own life by realizing that he has to save
his life. Right.
Because, I mean, yes, in the second one he fights a giant snake. But again, everything is just given to him.
It's true. Literally, a phoenix like
drops
a hat with a sword
and a magical sword appears,
and also tears to cure him.
To cure him, like it's just none of it is consequential because it just always resolves itself by itself.
Oh my god, you're so right. I never really thought about it in that way because even in the first movie, he only beats Quirrell at the end by accidentally touching his face.
He doesn't even figure it out.
He doesn't even know what the problem is.
Him.
Oh, that's true.
And then gets his hand burned off, and then Harry does the laying on of hands.
Yeah.
And that's it.
So it's like, he literally does nothing.
He always wins by default.
You're right. And then in the third movie, he's like, oh my god, I'm not going to just wait for my magical dad
and
to come back from the dead.
And that's because he says, I should just go into default mode because something is going to come along to save me.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh no, I have to do it.
Yeah. Which I loved because even watching it as a kid, I, like everyone, probably had the moment of, oh my god, it's him! Mm-hmm. He's the one who walks over there! Oh my god, time travel! Yeah, man, that movie handles time travel so well. I mean, we were talking about all of the moments where there are all these little hints visually that show the audience that things are moving in a linear fashion, which are kind of unnecessary, like the whole throwing the rock at the head thing. And
yes.
All of that, and Hermione's very out of character moment where she moves forward because she wants to look at the back of her hair.
Oh, what was that?
It's a very clumsy way of doing it. Like, she would not do that. That is very out of character.
Was that in the book or what? What was that?
No, that part is not in the book.
It was so silly.
It's a weird part in the movie that's like supposed to explain once again another, oh, they're right behind you kind of thing. But it's so out of character for her.
It just made her seem so vain.
Yeah,
I mean, I get it. She's a young teenage girl. But
she's so careful with everything else. She would literally never stop what she's doing so she could get a closer look at her hair.
Especially not when the stakes were so high.
Yeah.
And she even says it, like, she doesn't say it to Harry. She says it to herself, like, looking forward.
Yeah, like
says it to her other
over and
self.
Over again, like, we can't be seen, we can't be seen.
Yeah.
Like,
no, but she says out loud, is that what that back of my head looks like? Like, to herself across the way.
Yeah, it's a very strange moment because it's totally out of character for her.
Yeah.
But I do like how the time travel was shown to the audience because even though all of these little moments were not necessary, they were very necessary in terms of a movie. You know, in terms of understanding in that sense, like audiences that had never read the book could watch it and be like, oh, this is a linear narrative and this is how the time piece is working. And I just think it worked out really well.
I think for me, when I first read it, I loved the idea of the time travel and I thought the whole series had kind of gone into a different register with this structure of the end. But I think the more I think about it, the more questions it raises for me. Like, why does it never get used again?
Yeah.
Why? And I was saying this to you because I was getting kind of frustrated. I was like, why don't they just go stop Peter Pettigrew? Why don't they do it? They could have done
that. That's true. They could have done that. I mean,
they could have turned back time again. And like, then they could have had 15 different versions of themselves stopping the werewolf. I know.
You know what? I'm pretty sure in the book that they addressed that at one point.
Hermione just, and they say it in the movie that if you see yourself, you might go mad and.
Well, yeah, they do say that, but I think they honestly say something about why don't we go back in time and do this again or like stop Peter Pettigrew or whatever.
I think they say something might happen that would end the universe or
something
back,
like
back
that.
The
there's some sort of mention of if we do it again, we'll open up another timeline and like maybe the chances of us seeing ourselves is higher or something. They do give a reason in the book why they can't go back and do it again. Because really, they couldn't have saved Peter or stopped Peter Pettigrew in that iteration because there was too much other stuff going on and they weren't close enough and they would have run into themselves if they'd done
again,
it.
But again, like Marty McFly says, I have a time machine. I have all the time in the world.
Right.
He says, I have all the time in the world. I have a time machine. They could have gone back a third time and gone to the other side where Peter runs away and let him run into the forest, but then stop him in the forest. And then, do you know what I mean? Like, so again, you spoil the magic if you actually go to this degree of thinking about it. And the whole point is not, but I just found that they should have given some excuse as to why they can never use a time travel machine.
In the movie, at least.
Well, and for the rest of the series, like when spoiler alert, Sirius dies in the fifth one, why not use it then? Why can't they use it any other time?
I think, okay, I might be making this up, but
it's
possible that the reason they can use it is because Hermione has it at the time.
Uh-huh.
So I think that in the book, she has to give it back after.
And then where does it go?
I'm pretty sure McGonagall keeps it. Like, if McGonagall
gave it to
her,
never use it?
I don't know. I don't know because she.
Why the hell would they give this to a 13-year-old girl?
It makes no sense why they would give it to her. Literally, no sense at all. In the book, the only thing that it says is that Hermione wants to take like 8 classes, yeah. even though she only has time for 5 or something.
Yes.
So that's why she gets it, and she's trusted because she's Hermione. And like, what else is she going to do with it besides try to learn more? I'm pretty sure that she has to give it back, and it's never going to work unless she's wearing it, because obviously she couldn't turn back time to a time she doesn't have it. Like, that wouldn't make sense in the linear structure. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Like, if she was not wearing it, she could not go back.
Interesting. I hadn't thought of it in those terms, that it would need to be within a time frame in which she had possession of it. But I just feel like it's like the Philosopher's Stone. It's a piece of technology or magic that is so dangerous and so potentially disastrous that you don't even understand how this wizarding world has managed to survive to this point.
Right, because they have this.
Yeah, and so I think maybe there's an interesting Harry Potter, Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them movie to be made about, it's basically like having a thermonuclear weapon and deciding not to to flip the switch and set it off. Like, if you had a time machine, you could go and do anything, you could be anything, and you could do whatever. And none of it gets done. And so I would love to know the kind of politics that goes on behind the scenes.
Yeah, like whether they're regulated. And
why did they build it? What happened? And how is it that a society can still function in which there are time machines that are given to 13-year-old students?
Yep, on a little necklace.
Like, are there any other instances? Like, is wizarding espionage? Do they have time turners? Like, what would you do if the other side had a time turner? So these are all these questions that, came out of it the more I thought about it, not watching the movie. When you watch the movie, it all makes sense, and there's none of these questions. It's when you, like, are at home, you know, making dinner or something, and you're like, wait a minute.
Well, this is, yes, wait a minute. No, this is actually one of my biggest issues with the entire series. After reading the 7th book, I remember being unbelievably disappointed, because all I wanted to know was more about the world building and the dramatic effect of Voldemort dying and all of his followers and, like, what happens, because, you know, the wizarding world kind of reveals itself. Yeah, like, it reveals it. The wizarding world reveals itself to the muggle world to an extent. And the 7th book just kind of drops off with, like, and then Voldemort dies. And then 19 years later, everybody gets married and has kids. And I'm just like, I don't give a shit how many kids you had and how many dead people you named them after.
No, but like, he married Ginny,
He married Ginny. Like,
aren't you happy?
It was the biggest disappointment ever to me, because I was just like, but what happens to them? Do they become aurors? Like, they talk about aurors, but they never really talk about the job description in detail. It's just all about investigating the Death Eaters and such. And I'm like, well, what happens? Do the Death Eaters disband after Voldemort dies? What does an Auror do? What are their jobs? What happens? And did you ever read that sort of thing that was released several years later? It was like, I don't even remember where it was, possibly on that Pottermore website that, like, to this day is still maintained as Harry Potter universe. It outlined, like, what everybody's job was after Hogwarts. Harry and Ron became Aurors, and I don't remember what Hermione did, and Ginny became like a professional Quidditch player, and like,
whoa.
Yeah, like it. I don't remember.
And
everybody
this is canon?
Had, yeah, it is canon because J.K. Rowling wrote it and I think put it on this website.
Okay,
I'm pretty sure that happened. I find it interesting the sort of themes that each movie follows. Like, we've got the first ones, which are like the detective stories. The third one is like, oh, let's dig deeper into the past and actually learn more, because in the end, the Chamber of Secrets and all the discoveries that have to do with that have literally nothing to do with anything else at all.
Yep.
The only shred of continuity there is that the diary is a Horcrux, I think.
We don't even know that. I don't even know if she had planned it out that way.
I don't know either.
It becomes it's a sort of convenient George, like, Lucas kind of, oh, I always knew all along.
I don't even know if that was planned, but it turns out that that is one of them.
Yeah.
And that's the only shred of the whole second movie, Chamber of Secrets.
It does give
plot
you
that you get
a sense of the racial politics going on in this between the mudblood of the Muggles and like the.
I'm not saying that like the entire second movie is useless. I just mean the Chamber of Secrets.
I do think the entire second movie is useless. But I liked the way that they introduced that political aspect into the movie.
Yeah,
I just felt like for 2 hours and 42 minutes. To just get that in the way is like so pointless. And the third one, I just thought, did such a better job of actually introducing a sort of adult aspect that I felt it did a really good job of descending into adolescence, mm-hmm. where everything is just pain and misery.
Everything is pain.
And I just felt like, so obviously you know why Cuarón made this movie, or why he was offered this movie, because he had just done Y Tu Mamá También.
Yeah.
And they were like, hey, you seem to understand how teenagers function.
Yeah.
You should make a Harry Potter.
You made this movie.
Somebody watched about Y Tu Mamá También.
Two guys and a girl who are all best friends.
And have like a threesome at the end. Spoiler alert. Beautiful movie. Go check it out.
So good.
Somebody saw that and said, we want that, but with Harry, Ron, and Hermione.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it worked. And it worked out so well.
It's a road movie on brooms.
It is a road movie on brooms. And I think it's quite perfect that he only chose to direct this one.
Yeah.
Because afterwards he was just like, I'm done with this. Like, I've told the story that I want to tell, and I've given my little bit of magic to this movie, and like none of the other movies are the same because like they haven't been.
Then the series had to adapt to deal with this unknown element. It was this total revamp of the series. And so you couldn't just go back to more Nancy Drew nonsense.
Yeah.
Because now it's like, well, we have the third one. And like that's the Empire Strikes Back.
And the third,
the series is now different.
The third one is no longer about solving mysteries. Like, it's definitely about reacting to real world situations that are much bigger than all of the deductive adventures that the three of them have. It's literally like the whole movie is not about, oh my god, what mystery are we solving next? It's about them immediately, right away. Harry is on the night bus. He sees Sirius Black in the newspaper and he's like, who is that? And the tone is set right there with like the conductor just being like, Sirius Black is this horrible murderer.
Yeah.
And I did find it a little bit irritating and kind of hitting us over the head a little bit too much when from that moment, every single instance where somebody mentions danger, murderous plot, be worried for your safety, Harry responds with, does this have anything to do with Sirius Black? And it's like, yes, everything has to do with him.
Is but this also about the prisoner of Azkaban?
Yeah, like, also no.
Am I Harry Potter? And is there a prisoner of Azkaban?
I found it really, really annoying because, like, it's like, we get it. Sirius Black is going to be the focus of this movie, but it also just didn't seem realistic because I get it. He escaped. It's a big deal. Everyone's talking about it. But also, it's just like, not everything has to do with that. Everything in the entire world. It's like, imagine if in the movie, like, I don't know, a store gets robbed. Someone's held up at gunpoint. Does this have to do with Black? Probably not. Yeah.
Like, he's writing an exam. Does this have to do? Harry, just write the damn thing.
Write the damn thing.
I did. But so that's why I think that this one feels the most like a movie. Because it's so focused in the narrative that, you know, it's like Cuarón was like, okay, wait, what is the title of this movie? Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban. Okay, is this scene about Harry Potter and or the Prisoner of Azkaban? Okay, it's not in the movie.
Nope,
it's
cutting this part
out of the movie.
And
so it just goes, whereas in like the second one, I keep railing on the second one. I just think it's
so bad.
There were so many times where I was just like, where is this going? Why am I being shown this? Like, and again, it's in the book, but like, I don't care anymore. I don't remember the book.
Yeah, and the entire plot of the second movie, especially at the end, is so nonsensical. I was trying to figure it out last night when I was like, wait, why does Tom Riddle need Ginny Weasley's life force to come back to life?
Her skeleton.
Your skeleton will lie in the chamber forever. Why is she just lying there? And why is he like, she's almost dead. She's very, very nearly dead. Oh, her skin is cold as ice. She's pretty much dead. Like, this goes on for a long time.
Yeah.
And
I don't
it's
know,
like,
what is
why
this
does he need, why is she bringing him back to life? I don't get it.
Was he timing it or what?
What did he do to her? I didn't understand. Like, why was she just lying there? It didn't make any sense. And what was his plot actually? Like,
what were you gonna do?
Get her. So somehow mesmerize her with the diary into putting blood on the walls and opening the chamber. But okay, what I don't get is if she opened it and the basilisk came out.
How did it not kill her?
How did it not kill her? How did three separate people look at the basilisk through a reflection somehow?
Right. Yeah.
But it never kills Ginny, and she never looks at it. And it's like, what, she opens it up, and then it goes back in or something? Oh, because it's hanging out in the pipes?
Yeah.
Right. Right, right.
And
okay.
It survived 1,000 years, but I don't know.
Somehow. I mean, okay, fine. So I'm willing to accept that she lets it out because Tom Riddle wants it to kill the Mudbloods. But then at the same time, it's like he changes his mind.
Yeah.
He says so. He's just like, oh, I don't care about that anymore.
Yeah. Oh, like, now I realize that you're at the school, Harry, and now I'm going to kill you.
But why? This is
why?
The thing that I
How
don't understand.
Not know
why?
That? Also, like, so it's tethered to the book. So if the book doesn't see it, does Tom know about it? Like, did he not? How did he not know that Harry was at the school? Like, so.
But how did he know? Tom Riddle just exists as a memory in a book.
That's what I mean. Like, I don't understand. The logic of it doesn't make any sense for me. Maybe I'm sure someone is going to say in the comments it makes perfect sense, and here's why. But, like, I just felt there were so many, and again, they're like, don't ask the question, just don't spoil the magic, just
well,
go with it.
I just didn't get, like, could Tom Riddle get out of the chamber and walk around? Like, does he only exist in the chamber?
Is it a holodeck, or what is it?
Exactly, I didn't understand. Is he part of a holodeck? Like, does the diary have to be, like, near him for him to, like, come out of it? I just didn't understand. How was he going to move on?
And
if
then
he had succeeded with his plan.
Like, how does that Tom Riddle know about Harry Potter and everything that Harry Potter's done?
He couldn't possibly,
but he seems to know somehow that, like, oh, you're my arch nemesis who killed me.
It doesn't make any sense.
And I go on to become the greatest wizard of all time.
He's 16.
Like, how do you know this?
It doesn't make any sense.
Or are we supposed to, was it that the Horcrux was made, when was this Horcrux made? Was it made when he was making all the other Horcruxes? So at the same time as when he was a great powerful wizard? So Voldemort sat down and pretended to be a 16-year-old boy and write a diary so that he could, like, give it to Lucius Malfoy so that Lucius could give it to a ginger 50 years later? Like, it doesn't make any sense.
I would be very curious to know how this part of the plot was actually written out, because I've read the book, and at the time I remember not really thinking much of it and thinking, like, okay, so he's preserved in a diary, but I never really thought, when did he put, what he even says, like, I preserved myself as the 16-year-old in this diary. Why did he do that?
Unless he was 16 when he did it, in which case he wouldn't know about everything that he does in the future.
But
he
it's
seems
like,
to know.
He doesn't die when he's 16.
No,
that's the
he
thing.
Lives for like another,
so like maybe like 40 years
or something like that. So there's
40
years of memory, or 30 years, whatever, of memories that this character that we see in the second one doesn't have. But
doesn't
seems
have
to
at
have,
all, but he knows
because
who Harry is.
He knows who Harry is, and he knows to kill Harry.
And I also don't understand why he even wants to kill Harry, because like,
Work out so well the first time.
It didn't work out, and the whole reason he even wanted to kill Harry was because of the prophecy that he heard. So once he fulfilled that prophecy and Harry's alive, there isn't really any reason to kill him, to kill him again.
Right.
Or I guess he was still following the original prophecy of this wizard will rise up and kill you.
Which also happens.
Which happens.
Twice.
It happens twice, yeah.
Yeah.
Because,
or three times, because it happens again at the end.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
The end. Oh my God, the end is just, I feel like I can't wait to watch the last movie, because I think that the way it was described in the book is so ridiculous and hilarious to me. It almost ruins the entire thing, just how it happens.
Well, I haven't read the book,
yeah.
So I'm really excited
to
talk about that.
The movie makes it, the movie does it, you know, the way it happens in the book, but just the logic of it is so ridiculous.
Right.
It reverts back to this idea of things happening to Harry by accident.
Right.
And it, like, it's the worst thing ever. But
okay, well, we'll talk about that when
we'll get to that later.
I don't actually remember. I just do remember being very confused watching the
seventh
one.
Yeah, Noelle, we will talk about all of that, because you stopped reading after the fifth one, right?
After the fifth one.
Yeah,
yeah.
Because the sixth and seventh, there's a lot of stuff that's not in the movies, and I'm curious to know how you understood / interpreted the Elder Wand, having not read the book.
Yeah.
Because it makes almost zero sense in the movie.
Yeah, we'll talk about that. It'll be fun, I hope.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the cinematography in the third one.
Okay.
What do you make of all of the constant going into mirrors and seeing reflections and going through? The camera is just always fluid.
It's always moving. Yeah.
It's always moving. It's like, I guess it's like time. If you want to mathematic
like
here.
Time, yes.
But there's so many scenes, is it just Cuaron and Lubezki just being funny with the camera? There's so many scenes, like with the Bogart. Not Humphrey.
No.
Where the camera is like going into the cabinet and coming out the other side. It's a very kind of Robert Zemeckis kind of way of shooting that scene.
There are a lot of, there's a lot of different like perspectives that you see. Even that moment that I really liked where they're looking for the fat lady in the painting and you see the shot from the inside out. And it's like, I think that all of that movement is trying to show you that there are more things going on than what Harry or the audience sees. Like there are different perspectives. Like the shot with the cabinet is again, like showing what the cabinet sees or what's in there. It's like the whole movie is constantly trying to show you that there's more happening in the background. So maybe, I don't know if this is what they were thinking. They're trying to sort of allude to the idea of the time travel narrative at the end where they're all running around and they are watching themselves from a different camera angle and perspective.
I think you're onto something.
And
there.
I don't know if that's what that was intentional, but that's kind of how I see it because there's so much movement. Even Harry looks at his reflection on the train,
and then
that goes into the water, and it's almost to imply that there's something else out there looking in, which there was. There was the Dementor, so it's just showing different perspectives.
Oh, I really like because then the whole sort of tension in the movie is that Sirius Black could be anywhere.
Yeah,
and he's always so Harry just always feels watched in some capacity by someone. Or something.
Yeah, because the...
Which is something he's felt his entire life being... Well, not his entire life. His entire time since coming to Hogwarts.
Yeah.
Because he's the boy who lived, and so he's very famous. So he's used to people just sort of staring at him. But in this case, the stares are more insidious because he doesn't know who's looking.
Yeah, and that's... And I think that's kind of very intentional. Like, it is showing you all of these nooks and crannies and crevices of things that may be watching you. Actually, if you think about it from the Animagus perspective, it makes total sense because... Right in the beginning, he sees Sirius as a dog. He doesn't know it's Sirius, watching him from the shadows. Later on in the divination session, you know, Trelawney says, "You have the Grim," and that is the dog. And it's like he's being watched by things he doesn't know that he's being watched by. And, you know, Scabbers being a rat and watching everyone and everything without anybody knowing the entire movie. And it's like there's constant misdirection. Even that brilliant scene where they're in the Shrieking Shack and it's Lupin and Sirius having this big argument about killing Peter Pettigrew. And the audience thinks they're talking about Harry. Mm-hmm. Harry thinks they're talking about Harry. Nobody actually knows that they're pointing at the rat. It's so much misdirection and so much chaos and confusion. And the three of them are just like standing there waiting for something to happen, and Snape runs in, and it's like, it's so brilliantly done because there's so much confusion.
And, you know, just to be very obvious with it, the shack is itself shifting, like the allegiances and the perspectives in this movie. Another reason why I love this movie so much is that it's a sort of cohesive package that you don't have to sort of just get a good-looking movie, which is what you get in the first and second one. It looks nice, but it doesn't mean anything. The sets are what they are. They're just big and opulent. And in this one, it's like, I just felt like Cuaron was like, okay, how can I tell you this story using every single aspect of this world? Like, how can I use the magic in such a way that it's not just, ooh, look, there's a chocolate frog. The use of this white space, the way the wand creates that light between Harry and Snape creates this little kind of bubble of light. And there's just this constant use of bubbles of light.
Yeah, all over the place. Even the very first shot in the movie is him trying to practice that spell under his bed. Everything about it is everything about this movie is using the environment to foreshadow later events. Like, it happens over and over again. Like, you've got, you know, Molly Weasley running to the train with the rat being like, don't lose him. Yeah. And it's like, it's as if it's pointing to pay attention to this.
Yeah.
Because this will come up again. Just like the light will come up again.
And the light obviously is signifying the revelations that are going to be coming out by the end of this, where the sort of light is being shed on the past of all the little dark recesses of Harry's life that he never really knew about. And I just find that it's so well done.
Well, yeah, and there's a lot more mystery in the third movie that's more realistic and less obvious and less cheesy, because like in the first two movies, there are all these very obvious archetypes where, you know, Snape is consistently, you know, bullying Harry and they're always narrowing their eyes at one another. And there's all this like mystique surrounding, you know, what is Snape going to do next? And then same thing with Lucius. Like, there's just so much overacting, and he's evil, he's evil, he's evil. And then you've got the third movie where it's like, Sirius Black is this evil character who's insane, who's trying to come to kill Harry. And then the revelation that he's actually the Godfather. And then, again, like with the misdirection. And then, you know, you think Lupin is a good guy. And then all of a sudden they think he's a bad guy. And then they think he's a good guy again. And Snape, at no point in the movie, does what he did before in the previous two. He doesn't bully Harry Potter at all. He doesn't really do anything. Except for the one scene where he calls Hermione a know-it-all.
Mm-hmm. And takes 5 points from Gryffindor.
And takes the 5 points. Oh, man. Oh, that's true. That is the one reference to the House Cup,
Yeah.
In the whole
Thank
movie.
Thank God they got rid of that.
God, it was just so silly. It just nothing mattered. Who cares about the House Cup?
So there's a lot of things that were brought up there. One of the things reminds me, again, of the seeing without knowing that you're being seen. That's how Harry finds out about Sirius, as he sneaks into the room and is watching through the veil of the invisibility cloak. And there again, you have that change of perspectives between inside and outside. And, you know, again, it's like being on the periphery of knowledge and this kind of privilege and access to knowledge that Harry is moving towards. So that's also the main thing that distinguishes this from the other ones, is that the mystery is consequential. That it's not just, oh, there's a chamber from 1,000 years ago. It's like, no, this guy killed your parents.
Yeah.
And this guy is in league with Voldemort. And I liked how they didn't keep bringing up, oh, Voldemort's a thing, Voldemort's a thing.
Yeah, I remember loving this movie because it wasn't all about Voldemort.
Yeah, it was just about, it was about the damage that this man had wrought on the world.
Yeah.
And so it's that kind of thing, like, people's actions don't just go away. They ripple. They create consequences that people have to deal with for the rest of their lives. And this, the whole movie is like Harry just trying to recollect pieces of his mother and father. Like, and different characters are telling him, you look so much like your father, you have your eyes like your mother. Or, you know, this is how Lily behaved, this is how James behaved. And it's just all of this stuff that he's trying to shine a light
on. That is something that happens in the first two movies as well, but in this movie it happens a little bit more, and I like what you're saying about it showing the impact that Voldemort's actions had on a bunch of other characters, because in the first two movies it's just like, Harry, Voldemort kills your parents. He's gonna probably try to kill you if he comes back into power.
Yeah.
You've got to be afraid of him. You've got to kill him when you have the chance. And it's just like, okay. And then in the third movie, it's just like,
I just got to get to class.
Oh, yeah. And then the third movie, it's like, oh, Voldemort actually has a bunch of followers.
Mm-hmm.
This is a real thing. I mean, you don't really meet any of the Death Eaters, but you do start to get a little bit of a sense, again, because Draco uses the word mudblood a few more times. And you start to get a sense that, like, this is a really deeply ingrained thing, purebloods versus mudbloods. And you also see, okay, he ruined some guy's life. Azkaban is a real place. Like, it's a real place that you should fear. Because in the second movie, they do talk about Azkaban and sending Hagrid there. And you're just like, okay, Azkaban, it's a prison. In this movie, you see the Dementors and what they're actually like. You see Sirius, who's been in Azkaban for 12 years. He looks super skinny.
He
looks like tattooed.
Yeah.
He, like, looks terrible.
He went to a Turkish prison and he did things to him.
Basically, like, it becomes a real thing. And it's like, oh, my God, people's lives were actually dramatically changed by Voldemort. Mm-hmm. It's not just that he killed two people to be Harry's parents.
I love that scene where Peter Pettigrew is like, you don't know, and I know. And what would you have done? And then Sirius is like, I would have died. And, watching it again, I got a shiver because I'm just like, power does things to people, and it makes them do things that are really scary and stupid and ruins other people's lives.
Well, I think we're going to see a lot more of that in the other movies. Like, when Voldemort comes back and, like, what happens to everybody who was and is his follower conceptually, but then actually, like, I don't think any movie displays that better than the seventh movie with the Malfoys. The pressure that they start to feel and the crumbling of Lucius Malfoy's resolve. I love that so much. We'll talk about that when we get to that.
Yeah.
But it's so good. Thinking about it, I did want to talk about the music, because in the first two movies, the theme song is overused a lot.
Yeah.
Way too much. And then in the third movie, they introduce a lot more new music. It's like they're not just doing the exact same theme song as they did in the first two movies. I noticed that.
I feel like when Columbus was in charge, it was almost like he just wanted to make Indiana Jones, but with a kid, you know? And so we overhear the theme because it's like, oh, well, if this was Indiana Jones, you would hear the theme here because, you know, it's a sort of triumphant march thing. And in the third one, it almost felt like Spielberg had kind of taken over the reins and was like, no, this is how you do an Indiana Jones movie, right? Like, this is how you use the theme. Like, it was...
You don't overuse it. You just use it when it needs to be used.
And, you know, you use the music to sort of, like, suggest rather than just state things.
Yeah. Yeah, I found, like, in general, the first two movies seem very much like, oh my God, here is a book series that's just kind of getting off the ground. Make an adaptation of it that's as close as possible. Try to throw everything in there. Just like try to put everything in that you can. Versus the third movie is just like make a movie.
Yeah, I just mentioned the Indiana Jones thing because Chris Columbus actually did write a screenplay for Indiana Jones
for the
third one. It didn't end up getting used because I've read it. It's terrible. It was like Indiana Jones and the Monkey King.
That seems plausible considering the other stuff he gets up to.
Yeah, But so, you know, you watch this and yeah, again, it's all this kind of, it's a polished product that's supposed to be like an action adventure movie involving a young wizard. And by the time you get to the third one, it's a little bit more ambiguous and I think they're a little less concerned about making sure that the audience knows that this is a franchise.
Yeah.
And like setting up all of the little elements.
I think every movie kind of does that in this series. I mean, they're all trying to have some continuity. And they're all trying to connect to one another and be like,
in terms of narrative or
in terms of letting us know that it's part of a franchise.
I just felt like the design of this movie, I mean, was not at all worried about, ooh, what about the sequels?
Yeah. Well, this movie seems just like,
let's not worry about the leitmotifs and the music here. Let's not worry about,
well, it kind of establishes a lot of new things. Like it uses the, eye shots, the fading eye, fading in
the iris. Yes.
Right. Yeah. It uses those shots a lot. Yeah. No other movie does that.
Yeah.
It has
German expressionist. Like, yeah. There's a few scenes where I thought I was watching like Nosferatu or something.
Well, yeah. There's so much interesting stuff happening with the lighting and the colors as well.
Yes.
That very doesn't happen in the other. Yeah. Like the greens and...
Yeah. Well, that's Lubezki, the way he
writes. Right,
always...
yeah. But he didn't do the rest, right?
I don't believe so.
Right. Yeah, because it seems very different. And the handheld cam is not really used in any other ones.
Yeah.
And
well, they use
so...
a lot of handheld in the later ones.
Do they?
Yeah.
Okay, maybe I don't remember because it seems like in this movie...
Not to this extent,
it's
though.
So apparent and it's so almost like it doesn't look as polished, which is a good thing.
Yes.
And it this movie isn't really... Yeah, it's not really concerned with like keeping things consistent. Even the, you know, magical like... I can't do an impression of that noise, but... But every time the wand is used, like, there's just so much extra establishing stuff in this one. Where...
There's a lot more texture. But again, I just to reiterate that point, I just felt in the first and second one, they wanted you to be like, this is, like, a really polished product. And it's, like, it's a series, man.
Yeah.
And it's, like, it's all planned out. And we got all the money in the world here. And, like, we hired all the best people. And Quaron just sort of came in and he was like... Whatever, I'm making a movie about a kid. Like, I'm doing it.
I watched a lot of, actually, interviews and direction segments of Quaron and the kids. And just the way he is with them is so, like, what you just described. Like, he literally directs them and is just like, and then you just pretend you're doing this, and then you do that, and that'll look really good like this. Mm. It's like, he's not super concerned with even following the script.
Yeah.
As a straight up adaptation of the book, even though it's very, very close to the book, the way it ends up, it's just like, he's very much like, I want to just make a movie. And he knew he was only going to do that one when he started out.
But I also got the sense that he was going off the script, not going off the book. You know what I mean?
Yeah. A screenplay was written and that's what
it's the same thing with like, when you look at Itumama Tambien, when he was making that movie, it was like, he had all of the information in his mind, but when push came to shove, it was like, okay, what does the screenplay sort of lead me in this direction? Not like, oh, well, the screenplay says this, but if you remember in the book, it's like this thing happens and that thing happens. It was just like, no, this is the product that I'm making. It's based off of this document here, not this other document. So I'm not going to worry about what the other document. Like, that was the thing that you were talking about when... there's no reference made of how Remus knows about the map.
Yeah, that's like literally my one major pet peeve of the whole movie, that, like, there isn't a single line that references it.
It's really, if you're like looking at all the information contained in the book, it's kind of a weird omission
It is, because there's all these situations where Remus knows it's a map. He knows to say mischief managed. He, like, even Sirius says the map
knows,
never lies.
Yeah,
like,
he knows about
how
it.
Do they know that?
Yeah.
Why doesn't it tell you that they made it?
And like, there was all this background stuff that you were telling me about, like, oh, with the Animagus, like, they became Animagus.
I really think that that should have been mentioned, because it was a very big testament to how close the four of them actually were.
Yeah.
And the sense, and it would have actually lended like much more credibility to the idea that the Patronus in the end was actually Harry's father, because the whole thing is that when he practices the Patronus charm, it manifests as a deer, and that's why he chooses that animal to transform into after Lupin gets bitten by. That's why they call him Prongs. And like that, if we'd known that, then we would have been like, oh, maybe it is actually Harry's dad doing it.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, you kind of think that maybe that's the case in the movie anyway, but it just, there's no connection made to any of that. I'm sad that they didn't mention it, because even Peter Pettigrew also trains himself to become a rat. Even though he's a very despicable character with no redeeming qualities, it would have really solidified the idea that the four of them were best friends.
But
that they did this for Lupin so that he wouldn't feel like a total freak because he was also an animal.
There again, I'm trying to go back to what I was saying with he's got the document in his head and he's just kind of trying to make that into a movie. Like, with Y Tu Mamá También, there's like 60 pages of notes on all the backgrounds of these characters' lives that he and the actors created, none of which is in the movie. Like, it's not even, they don't even have dialogue mentioning it.
Yeah.
You just feel it, though. Like,
yeah,
when you read this document, I was, you know, and I showed it to you, and I was like, well, look at all this stuff that's in here. I was not surprised, really, to learn any of it, even though it was brand new information that I was hearing. I just felt that because Cuarón had done such a good job of conveying the sense of that information without sort of saying, but what does the book say?
Yeah, and I totally agree with you. A scene from Y Tu Mamá También that is probably the best example of that for me is the part where Diego Luna is using the bathroom and he shuts the lid with his foot instead of his hand. And that right there is, like, for me, the largest signification of their class difference that is never really mentioned explicitly. But it's kind of like his way of being like, I can't touch this with my hand. Like, he's my best friend, but that's one thing I can't do. But it's like that, and that's just an example of exactly what you're saying. Like, 60 pages of notes about the background of the characters that isn't mentioned explicitly, but is conveyed in all of these little subtleties so that the audience can piece it together. Yeah. Like, this happens in this movie as well. If somebody would really think about it and watch the movie many times and think to themselves, wait a second, the four of them are the Marauders and they made this map. Like, somebody could figure that out, but I feel like I was just upset because nobody bothered. Nobody I knew that had seen the movie that hadn't read the books had made the connection. So I think that...
Well, that's why I think this movie is so interesting, because he almost doesn't, and that's what I was trying to say about the book, is he doesn't treat it like it's based on a book.
Yeah.
You know, and he wants to allow someone who's coming at it from just watching the movie to have these kind of moments of discovery and revelation themselves, to kind of shine the light in their own little recesses of the scenario. And yeah, because you could, if you thought about it, you could piece it together from watching the movie.
Yeah.
What was going on, because we were doing it. We were like, he said this, you know, there's these, let's count up how many people there are. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
And what are the, you know, and Harry reads out the names of the people of the, you know, Mooney, Padfoot, Wormtail, and Prongs, and then they call him Wormtail. Like, it's all there. It's just, they don't have someone sit down and say, now, Harry.
And it's true. It is all there. I think that the reason it seems like an omission to me is there are so many other situations in the movie where things are clearly spelled out.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just like, why do they leave out this bit?
It would be interesting to go back and kind of correlate the moments at which they bother to spell things out and sort of ask, why was this aspect, like, why did Cuarón think this was useful to to make sure that the audience understood, and well, why was something else not
there
useful?
There are a couple parts where I thought this seems too obvious, like the part where Hermione explains to Harry, this is how I've been getting to all my classes. I get that she says that, whatever, it's fine, yeah. But you don't need to know. There are three situations where Ron makes a big deal about the fact that she wasn't there before. Yeah. It's obvious that that's what she's been doing. That's just one example of many in the movie where things are spelled out for you.
And I felt like those were the weird kind of concessions that you would have gotten in the first two.
Exactly.
Where
exactly,
it was like,
where things are
for
just
the
like
audience following at home,
highlighting
if
for
you,
you
don't
yeah.
get it, this is what's going on. You know, like, yeah, they have to spend so much time because I think they were afraid the audience would look at the time travel and sort of check out. Like in Back to the Future Part 2, the guy has to bring out a blackboard and kind of show you what alternate timelines look like, because like you might not be able to put both of these things in your head.
Well, and that's exactly what happens, because after Harry does the Patronus, it was very unnecessary for him to have like a 10-second exposition of like, I was actually seeing me, not my dad.
Yeah.
It was me. I'm the one who did it.
Harry,
I'd already done it. It was me. Like, he says it over
and
over.
Can you just fly Buckbeak to the... And Hermione doesn't get it somehow.
And then Hermione doesn't get it. She goes, does that make sense? No. I'm like, what do you mean no?
You've been doing this for a whole year. How do you not...
How do you learn nothing? How do you not get it? In fact, what's funny is I kind of forgot that part a little bit. So when he explains all that and her expression is a little bit... I thought her expression was actually like, duh. Like, I guess that's what I thought her expression meant.
Yes.
It's so obvious that it was actually him. But then he goes, does this make sense? And she goes, no. And I'm like, what?
Yeah.
But you're Hermione.
You get everything.
You thought of all of this first.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just...
Real quick, let's just talk about the endings of each of these movies.
Oh, the endings.
The final scenes.
We must. Okay.
We must, because the first one, I think, did a really good job of saying more adventures to come.
Yeah.
The second one, I almost didn't want to watch a single other one.
The second one is the worst ending ever.
Yeah.
Wait, so let's just back up. Why do you think the first one is so great?
Because Harry realizes Hogwarts is now his home.
Yes.
And I think that's a great way of setting up what this place means to him, because it's really important in the later ones that Hogwarts isn't just a castle, it's home.
Right.
And he will die defended
at this
point.
She says, like, it seems weird to go home, and he goes, I'm not going home. Like,
yes.
So that makes total sense. And I like it, but I also think it's cheesy as hell.
It's not the best.
A million extra points for Gryffindor for doing all of this.
Oh, I didn't even mean that, but yeah, we could talk about that too.
The House Cup is just like they drop it.
Well, it's the sort of Star Wars throne room credential scene, you know, where they get presented with the medals.
Okay, so
Joseph Campbell, you know, the hero's journey.
It is true. It's like coming back. These are all the things you've learned. You're presenting. It's funny to me.
And you have the medals to show for.
Well, I learned all about that part at the end of the denouement when you come back and the awards ceremony and then
you grant the boons to the village.
Yeah. And then, you know, I burst out laughing when that part happened in Willow.
Right? George Lucas was the producer.
Of course. So like it cracked me up, because at the end of the movie, they're all just dressed in like their finery. They all look like 1,000 times cleaner than you've ever seen them in the whole movie.
The final battle wasn't a rainstorm, so they did get washed.
They did get washed. But no, it's just so ridiculous that it's like, and now we will present you with all of these awards, and you guys all look so cleaned up. Yeah. It was so ridiculous.
Well, that's the ending of The Return of the King, right?
Where they all get bowed down to, it's very ceremonial.
For me, it works in all of these movies. Except for the House Cup, because the House Cup is so friggin' inconsequential. It doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter at all, it's interesting.
It's not even an emotional payoff, because I haven't cared.
Yeah, nobody cares. There's no consequence to losing the House Cup. There's
also,
no
the point
reward
system doesn't make any sense.
To gaining the House Cup. It's like, and Slytherin's the winner because Gryffindor broke all these rules. But actually,
because they broke more rules, here's some more points.
These are more points that are just given to them at random numbers, like 50, 50, 60, 10, 5. Like,
wouldn't it be great if they'd gotten all those points and like, oh, we're still last?
Yeah, they're still the last ones. Yeah,
I'm sorry, I never took math.
It's like when you're playing a board game that's based on a point system, and in the end you cash in all of your points and you gain like 200 points, but you're still in last place.
It's
the same feeling of being let down.
It's like playing solitaire. from a, again, and that's what I mean about the, it's in the Indiana Jones, the finished final product. Like it's all product that we're being sold here. With the third one, well, let's talk about the ending in the second one, because again, they had no idea how to end this
movie.
They had
no idea.
So they just kind of repeat the ending from the first one.
They repeat it, but they don't talk about the house cup for some reason, even though in the second movie, they make a big deal of the points. Like right in the beginning, they're just like, they take points away from Harry and Ron because of the whole car thing, and they do mention the points a few times, but then at the end, they don't talk about the house cup at all. You thought this didn't matter in the first movie. It actually does matter. We're never going to talk about it again.
Legitimately is pointless.
And then they don't know how to end it. And then, like, Hagrid comes in and that whole long scene of everyone clapping. Like, I get that Harry, Ron, and Hermione are happy to see Hagrid, but literally the entire Great Hall is clapping.
Yeah.
Nobody knows why.
Yeah. And it's the most, like, it must have been so awkward to film. Like, y'all are so happy and you're clapping. And
all y'all try to get to Hagrid and clap for him. Like, why?
It was just so bizarre and I couldn't understand. And it was so hokey and it felt, and then the swell of the music. Like, by the way, this is a,
that is the end of the movie, yeah.
Feel good, right? Like, this is, well, I'm sorry we scared you. The snake was frightening. You might be traumatized. Don't worry. We're all applauding.
Don't worry. Everyone's fine. There are no consequences. Actually, yes. Ugh. So this was the big thing. The third movie is the only time where at the end you feel like there has been some difference made, some impact, and something has happened. And I love that Harry comes in and goes, none of it made any difference. Mm-hmm. And Lupin's like, what the fuck are you talking about? Of course it did. Which I loved because as the audience, you're thinking to yourself, everything they do in the first two movies, it ends all neatly and everything is fine. And then in the third movie, yes, they do help Sirius escape, but also he's on the run now for the rest of his life and Harry can't go live with him. And that is like this very heartbreaking moment because you think he's finally going to have a real home and he can't.
And I was saying this to you while we were watching the movie. It was so cruel that their sort of final moment before Lupin turns into a werewolf is Harry saying, what, live with you? And he meant it like, yes, I would love to do that.
Yeah, and he never
and
really
Sirius,
knows it.
Sirius just thinks he meant, oh, why would I want to live with you?
Yeah, exactly. And
the movie,
it's heartbreaking.
It's so horrible. Yeah. And I just felt
because
so bad.
Because they don't have a chance to really reconcile
but
that
I
at
love
all.
That the movie did that. That there, it sort of leaves everything in suspension in a wonderful, sort of useful way.
Well, but then, I mean, they do have the moment where Harry goes like, could I go with you?
Yeah.
And Sirius is like, no, that's a bad idea.
Yeah.
So I guess like, it's not like Sirius leaves thinking that Harry didn't want to live with him.
The movie's not that cruel.
But I do like that part that like it's Harry comes so close to like having a family and like someone who understands him. And I always, after watching that, I always thought to myself, like, how awesome would Harry's life have been if he got to go live with Sirius? Like, it'd be amazing. And I felt genuinely bad that it didn't work out.
There's a lot of moments in the movie where they have like something wonderful that gets destroyed. Or not something, but something whimsical, you know, like the bird that is like...
The bird, yeah.
Tweet, 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 and it... And it gets killed by the tree. Or like the flowers that are all nice and beautiful, and then the Dementors just go over and they like wither and die.
Everything is very temporary.
Yes.
Just remember everything is temporary.
Memento mori for everything.
Yeah.
But then the very, very last shot of the third movie, I felt was so...
So weird.
So weird. I don't get it.
It's just very strange. Like, okay, so at the end, I feel like they didn't know how to end the third one either.
Yeah.
It's very much like, okay, everything has happened. We don't even know what time of year it is, to be fair. Because, like, so we assume it's somewhere close to the end of the year.
I guess there's just no...
They've kind of stopped going to class. Like, I don't know. There's no more class stuff. And at the end, you know, okay, Harry's got a new broom, which is cool, but at the same time, you're just like, oh, right, his broom broke. At least I didn't really remember or care. I just kind of thought, yeah, okay, they had the one Quidditch game, his broom broke. I'm sure they can get him a new one. Like, everybody else has the, you know, the stock Quidditch brooms.
Yes.
Like, he's the only one who even has a fancy one.
Yeah.
So I wasn't really that worried about his broom breaking. Like, and then it's like, what do we do now? Fly into the sunset. Like, it's a very weird way to end it.
And the weird streak of motion, like...
It's very strange.
I would love to get someone who's, like, a cinema expert try to explain to me why we need to have the, you know, the face streaking across.
Yeah, it's a weird
on
thing
his,
to
like,
do.
Weird, and he's, like, a joyful, exuberant face, like, that's not being totally captured in the frame. It's a transitory. I'm trying to figure out what I'm looking at.
I feel like every single person saw that last shot and cringed. Because it's just the freeze frame ending is not a modern thing.
They do the same thing in like Spider-Man 2 with the weird...
Oh God, Spider-Man.
Hey, Spider-Man 2 is great. Where they do the... not the new reboot.
I've never seen the new ones.
The original. Okay.
Yeah.
Problem. Where they do the, you know, sun drops, he's falling on my head. And then he has that kind of moment where it's like a freeze frame.
Yeah.
Go off. I am trying to think. I've seen a lot of movies, but I'm trying to think of where I've seen that kind of a shot done and what. So is he referencing something or what? Like, it's. Or maybe I'm thinking about it way too much. Like, it was literally just, I don't know what to do.
I don't know how to end this.
Like,
well, I think it would have been way better if they wanted to end it with him flying off on the broom. Would have been better if he just. Blown off into the sunset. It would have been like, oh, it's like the hippogriff.
Yeah.
You're free. Like, you have a new broom now. Like, the knowledge has set you free. Obviously, it was Sirius who sent them the broom, and it's like...
And I just felt like it was one of those, to go back to another Spider-Man movie, the end of Spider-Man 2, the Amazing Spider-Man, the new one, where it's like Gwen Stacy dies. Then in the next scene, he's swinging back into action, and it's like, oh, everything's fine and hunky-dory, and... Your girlfriend died, but it's okay. You'll get over it. Like, his emotions are taking flight again, and he's lifted up. The journey continues. I felt the same way when I'm watching this one, where it's like, this was really intense, guys. There was a werewolf. You know, Snape was wearing a dress. Like, a lot of shit happened in this movie. Don't worry. It's okay.
He's flying off on a broom. Yeah.
And again, it's that same thing with the hero's journey. He gets the gifts, or he gets the reward, sort of shares it.
Well, yeah. I think that Harry is given a reward of some kind at the end of each of these.
All right. Well... Thank you for listening.
Thank you so much for listening.
Swish and flick.